Can you hear me okay? Okay. Good evening, everybody. My name is Simon. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And first of all, I just want to thank Dave and Vic and the committee for the opportunity to do this, to share my experience from Hope and what I was like, what happened and what I'm like now. But also to talk from my experience and knowledge out of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I was here last year and met Dave and Vic and the guys last year, and it's been an honour to walk this path with them over the last year. I introduced myself as a recovered alcoholic. That's what I've come to experience as a result of working the 12 steps out of the first 164 pages of this book. I also no longer suffer from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that drove me to the gates of insanity and death of a killer of disease called alcoholism. The first few pages in the forewords to this book and the forward to the first edition, it gets quite specific on how we're going to recover from this, based on following a plan of recovery that's estimated and that's outlined in the first 164 pages of this book. It's what I've come to experience and it's what I've come to share with you this evening. The doctor's opinion, in the first couple of pages of the doctor's opinion, it says the message that must hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And that's what I've come to experience here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is recreation of my life. I came here to stop drinking, and I came here to treat the disease that I was suffering from. And initially, when I first approached the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1998, I was given a lot of information that was contrary to what's in this book, and I thought this business was about just not drinking. And I was told that this business was just about not drinking, and for me, that wasn't enough for me. Just to rewind the clock back, my home group is the primary purpose group in the south of France. We are a Big Book study group. We study and we practice, which means carrying out the instructions suggested in the first 164 pages of this book. We meet three times a week. We're actively involved in carrying this message from this book into hospitals, institutions and wind-up places. And we sponsor people fairly strongly. And we're actively involved in helping newcomers if they want this solution through the plan of recovery estimated in this book. My sober date is June 20th, 2003. I've been sober 3.5 years today. I've never ever been sober 3.5 years today before in my life. That wasn't the first sobriety date that I had here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had 5 sober dates before the June 20th, 2003. I approached this work outlined in this book for the first time coming from the point of a chronic relapser in Alcoholics Anonymous. To explain in a general way, and I mean in a general way, what I was like, what happened and what I'm like now, that would lead me on to the experience I've had and continue to have with these steps in this book, is I was born into a very, very nice home. My father was a policeman and my mother was a policewoman. And I'm here. So, you know, I understand today that my alcoholism is not causal, and it certainly wasn't brought on by any type of situation that happened to me as a young child, or where I lived, or what my family environment was, or how I was brought up, or what education I had, or what didn't happen, or what did happen when I was young. And it was a great home. And the reason I share that is that I was given many, many warnings as a very young child from my father as to, son, if you drink, this is what will happen. And he'd point to a drunk on the street. Son, if you do the other stuff that tradition 10 doesn't allow me to talk about in here, but if you do the other stuff, this is what will happen. And I had many, many warnings as a young child growing up from my father and from my mother in a very gentle and loving way. However, none of those warnings crowded into my mind when insidious insanity of the first drink was upon me. I was unable to bring into my consciousness the warnings that I'd had from my father and from my mother many, many times. And growing up, the spiritual malady was alive and well inside of me from a very young age. The doctor's opinion talks about, you know, the three areas of spiritual malady for me, which is restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. You know, and that's when I first heard that. Fifth time around in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could relate to it. I can understand, you know, that state of being. And that's how I grew up. I was restless around most people. I was irritable around everybody. And I was unhappy pretty much with everything after a period of time. You know, where I lived, where I went to school, what I wore, you know, what the other children have. I didn't have it. And it was just, you know, I was disappointed with everything and very, very miserable from a very young age. And that state of being and that state of living for me became more and more uncomfortable as I got older. And subsequently, because of the behaviour that came out of this condition, my parents thought it was the school I was living in, or they thought it was the town that they were living in, or it was maybe it's because of the people that I'm hanging out with, or maybe it's because of this, or maybe it's because of that. And it, as we know today, it's nothing to do with that. However, they did their best and they tried to change my environment to get me comfortable in my own skin. And subsequently, I went to about 8 different schools in 11 years, and would go from, you know, living in Hertfordshire to living in East London, you know, to living back down in Essex, to going back to Hertfordshire, and it was just changing schools all the time from one school to another. And, you know, when I'd turn up in these schools, they'd send me to a private school because they thought, you know, the education is better there, he's going to look smarter, he's going to meet a different, a better class of person. And, you know, I'd turn up to this school and the outfit would, I'd have a pink cap, a blue blazer with pink outlines, and I'd wear these socks and these shoes, and I'd turn up with a briefcase. And after a period of time, I'd become restless, irritable, discontent, bored, I wouldn't attend lessons, and the same old a problem would continue to arise. So they'd take me from that school into another school. And I'd turn up at another school, which was a grammar school, not a private school, but I'd turn up dressed in private school clothes to a grammar school with a briefcase and a cap and shiny shoes and everything else. And everybody else in this school had graffiti on their rucksacks, trainers on, you know, and I'd turn up how I was dressed. And subsequently, you know, I never quite felt as though I really belonged anywhere. I never quite really felt as though I fitted in anywhere inside. And it became more and more uncomfortable living for a long period of time. I had a wonderful younger sister. She's a couple of years older, younger than me, sorry. And it, you know, the family home started to become restless, irritable, and discontent because of my restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. I picked up alcohol age 13, and the restlessness, the irritability, the discontentment, the boredom, the indecision, the doubt, the fear, the uselessness, all of this underlying condition that I'd felt all of my life disappeared for the first time. I remember my first drink like it was yesterday. It absolutely changed me at a level that I dreamed it would change me at, and it allowed me some relief in my own body and in my own mind. And I liked it. And I couldn't wait to drink again. And I'd get back to the family home, and I'd see these guys out on the street smoking, drinking and hanging out. And I'd be up at my window with my family, and I'd be looking out of that window, and I really wanted to be out there with them doing what they were doing. And I wanted to be part of what they seemed to be doing. And I saw the liquor in their hand, and I saw the alcohol, and I really wanted that again, because I wanted that feeling of ease and comfort that it gave me that first time I had it. And there were no horrific consequences after the first drink. It just made me feel good, you know, and it seemed to fix and sort out this internal agony that I'd felt inside of myself from a very, very young age. And I'd go out and I'd hang out with these people, and I wasn't particularly popular because of what my parents did for a living. And in the neighbourhood I was growing up in, it wasn't cool really to have two parents who were police officers, you know. And subsequently, with the people that I wanted to be around and were smoking what they were smoking and drinking what they were drinking, it didn't kind of match up, and they were not going to tell you too much, you know, because we'd already taken it home. And I never really felt as though I could really connect with these people or fit in there. That was age 13. I didn't know it at the time, but the disease started to progress within me. And I'd go out and I'd continue to drink on a Thursday or Friday after school. I didn't particularly do well at school. I didn't have, I have a great opportunity for education, but I was never really there. And I wasn't able to, I didn't really want to do what was on offer. I found this solution for me called alcohol that worked, and it stopped me feeling the way I was feeling and thinking the way I was feeling, and I just wanted to do more of that. And I finished my education and I wanted to go out to work. I have no qualifications or education, but I knew I had to go to work to get money to work. And I started to become, age 17, I've always been a salesman since the age of 15. And I wanted to go out to work because I wanted money to go get drunk again and buy alcohol so that it would continue to help me treat what was wrong with me. I didn't know it at the time. And, you know, I had a lot of successful years drinking. I also became addicted to other substances. Again, Tradition 10 doesn't allow me to talk about in here. I'm also a recovered drug addict, and I go to another fellowship to treat that. What I don't do is talk about my experiences with that in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe in singleness of purpose, and I believe in the fifth and the tenth tradition that tell me I have one primary purpose, which is to talk, carry into this message to alcoholics. And I have to be mindful of that in here. And disease started to progress. I continued drinking as I was working. And I started to become very, very successful, and I had a job offer in the city of London. And, you know, by this time, my family were just happy that I was working a lot because the home was starting to become ill. In fact, at this time, I was drinking a lot, but it wasn't so much what was happening when I was drinking, because when I was drinking, I was getting better. What was happening for me was what in the home was what was happening when I wasn't drinking. And I'd go home into the home and I'd become very angry, I'd become very afraid. Selfish and inconsiderate habits had kept this home and started to keep this home in turmoil. My mother and my sister became very ill as a result of my alcoholism. My mother became under prescription from a doctor. And these like beta blockers that she was taking, and my sister at the age of 16 was on antidepressants, and alcoholism already started to manifest itself within my family. I would leave the home and I'd go and drink some more and come back, and they'd wonder what time I was going to come home, where I was going to be, what the next phone call is going to be like. And what state I was going to be like when I came home and the subsequent weeks following that. They became very, very ill as a result of that. My father passed away when I was 18, and he had an early death. It was a shock death. And for me, it was an excuse just to drink. And it was like, you would drink if this has just happened to you. You know, I was justifying the reason why I was drinking. My family became ill. I started to become quite successful. I don't know how that quite worked, but I was always able to get up early in the morning. I was always able to attend my job. I was always able to carry out that because I knew I was getting money to go drink. And you know, Bill describes in his story that financial leaders were his heroes. And at the age of 17, city traders and city salespeople were my heroes. And I'd have a very local job, and I really want to be in London because in London, it's great. They earn a lot of money, they look well, they're powerful people, but they're able to drink at lunchtime and after work. You know, and it was a great place for me, I wanted to be there. And I'd read the Financial Times at 17, I'd not have a clue really what it was about. And at 17 years old, I'd have a pinstripe suit. And I'd have the Financial Times under my arm, and then I'd be going up into the city to work. And these individuals became my heroes, and I'd look at people making lots of money, this is what I want, and this is what I need, and this is how I should be living. And I was never very comfortable on the inside, and I did become quite successful. My father passed away, and the disease started to progress. The other stuff that I was taking started to take its toll, financially, emotionally, mentally. And I started to become very, very unhappy. My family at the time were becoming worse. They would shut their doors in the evening. They would only give me a key for the back door so that I wouldn't wake them up when I came home. And they started to feel as though they were prisoners in their own home for me. My mother subsequently has told me that she felt like a battered wife and kept going back for more with the behaviour that she accepted in the home. I became successful. I was making money, and the money was going on drink, on other stuff, and I'd start drinking on Thursday nights. The people that I was drinking with at the time seemed to have several drinks, make a decision and say, excuse me, I'm leaving, I need to go home and attend to my family, I need to go home and attend to my wife. And this was around 11 o'clock. And I couldn't understand that. Why would they leave here and go home when alcohol is being served? Surely it's not doing for them what it's doing for me. But they seemed to be able to manage the decision after a couple to stop and go and attend to other stuff. And what I started to see around me was people drinking with impunity. People drinking without any serious consequences. And what I'd see is that I'd start drinking, and after they didn't seem to be getting the effect that I was getting from it. I didn't really like the taste at all, but what I did do is I drank for the effect, the chemical produced inside of my body. The trouble is that once that chemical took effect, alcohol took effect inside of my body, and I had that sense of ease and comfort, I couldn't seem to be able to guarantee how much more I'd drink. And I couldn't guarantee to my mother the commitment I made to her earlier to be back at home in the evening. Other people seemed to be able to do that, I couldn't. And I'd often find myself, you know, they'd call last orders at a bar, and I'd go, you know, somewhere else to a drinking joint in Charing Cross Road, and then to finish the job. And subsequently, the next morning, I'd ring my mum, and I'd say, by the way, I'm not coming home. And I think she said, you know, I know. And this, at certain times this happened, not all the time, but at certain times this happened. And after a period of time, the Thursdays became Fridays, and the Fridays became Saturdays, and I wasn't really working. I was going to work early in the morning, and there was a pub in Clerkenwell near the city that opened at 5 a.m. for first orders. At the moment I found that out, you know, it was great, because what it done is it allowed me to drink until 2 a.m. at a drinking establishment in Charing Cross Road, and then go to Clerkenwell for first orders, and then go to work. And what started to happen is that there were consequences to my lack of control and to my lack of choice around my drinking. And I started to lose jobs, and my external world started to fall apart. And I'd continually make promises to my mother and to my sister and to everybody around me, my employers, that I'm not going to do this next time. You know, I'm sorry I'm late. Or, you know, I will be in Friday. And I'd make these promises to people, and I wouldn't be able to fulfill them. But I had this very, very serious intention to turn up for work on Friday. What I started to experience was I'd make promises. I'd be caught in what the book talks about as a strange mental blank spot, and I'd break the promise in the home, in the workplace, and in other areas of my life. Let's fast forward this bit. 22 years old, I had most of the external circumstances that happened to us happen. I'd lost jobs. I'd have a drink driving ban. that it's not just exclusive to people who suffer from alcoholism either, and it certainly wasn't, it didn't make me an alcoholic just because I had a drink driving ban. And all of this stuff started to happen for me, and I was unable to stop, and I desperately wanted to stop for a period of time. I felt as though every day I hated the job I was doing, I hated the person I was becoming. I could see the hurt in my mum's eyes and in my sister's eyes and in my employer's eyes, and I could see how it was affecting them, but I was unable to do anything about it. At 22 years of age, I absolutely lost the will to live. I was unable to hold down any form of relationship. This internal spiritual malady that the book talks about had really taken its toll with me. I hated who I was. I had absolutely no self-esteem. I was plagued with a feeling of uselessness. I was having trouble in personal relationships. I couldn't control my emotional natures. I'd spent everything in my bank account continuously. And at 22, I attempted suicide. And for me, this was not a cry for help. I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to live anymore with the voices that were going around in my head. I didn't want to live anymore with the way I was living my life. And I didn't want to live anymore with the way I was feeling and what I was doing to people around me. And I was unable to stop it. These outside issues brought me to my knees quite quickly, and I had some mental consequences as a result of doing that. And the book talks about, in the other chapter, the book talks about given sufficient reason, can you stop or moderate? And I had a lot of reasons to stop. I wanted to stop, but I couldn't stop. I had to stop several times, but I couldn't manage the decision to stay stopped. I hated who I'd become as a person and what I was doing to people around me, and I could see no way out. I desperately wanted to stop but couldn't, and the only way out I saw for me was suicide. I came back from work one night after trying to hold it together for another day, and I went to the cabinet and I got a pots full of pills, and I tried to attempt suicide. And what happened with me is that I woke up the next morning and the window was open in my room. The notes that I'd written out to everybody had gone, and I'd woken up very disappointed that I was still living, and I didn't want to be awake. I put my suit on and I tried to go to work and try and hold it together one more time. But I knew that by 10, 11 o'clock I'm going to be loaded again, and I'm not going to be able to get through the day. My mum saw how the disease was progressing, and she saw the deterioration of my human condition, and she said, I think you need to go see someone. And I started seeing this lowest rung counsellor who was under the Mental Health Act, and she was in this outpatient facility, and she'd come and see me once or twice a week, and we'd talk about a lot of stuff, and we would look at some of the reasons, and we'd talk about, you know, my dad, and, you know, was it because he was a policeman that I was rebelling, or I was defiant, they called it in the home, and it wasn't, and we'd agree it was, and then I'd get drunk again, and she'd come round and I'd be drunk again. And what happened is, the book talks about in the other chapter that we enter stages of asylums and institutions, and I was taken to a detox facility where I spent a week there, and they tried to withdraw me from the alcohol and the chemicals that I was taking, and they'd tell me to go to AA. And I went to an AA meeting there, came out, and I went and got drunk, and my mum wouldn't allow me in the home. She'd stopped me living there, and she said that she wanted me to go to a night shelter, and I went to a night shelter, and then I was put in another psychiatric unit, and it just went on and on and on for about a year and a half. I didn't stop drinking. I could do for about 3 or 4 weeks, but what happened inside of me was the spiritual malady would come back. I'd start suffering from all of this internal discomfort and the voices would be driving me wild, telling me that, you know, I'm not going to get this, or she's going to leave, or I'm not going to get paid that, or how I'm never going to quite live up to the way you're living. And I'd go get drunk again. I was unable to stop drinking, given sufficient reason. What I learned in these facilities is that I was shielded from alcohol. What happened in these facilities is they were able to deal with the physical part of the illness, but they were not able to treat the mental and spiritual part. And I will never ever do an injustice to those facilities, because I think they did a great job of the physical piece. However, I suffered from a threefold disease of alcoholism, and as we know, when the mental piece and the spiritual piece are not treated, but the physical piece is, the mental piece will get me back to the drink. The mental piece will get me back to the drug all the time. These facilities tried to help me. I'd keep drinking, and I was taken to another treatment centre in the south west of England, where I was for 7 months. And if the truth is that I had not fully conceded to my innermost self that I was a real alcoholic. And I went to treatment, and I had group therapies, two a day. I had one-to-one counselling. I had videos, and I learned a lot about what they believe I suffered from. But today I understand that self-knowledge avails me nothing, and that I need to experience power in order to recover. I was in that treatment facility for 7 months. I hadn't worked all of the steps as they're outlined in this book. I'd worked some of the steps. I treated them like a homework assignment. And I came out of treatment, and within about a month and a half, I was drunk again. And I went back to the treatment facility, and they said, you know, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, okay, I'll go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is my experience, and I know that it's a lot of other people's experiences, but it may not be some of other people's experience. But, you know, I went to AA, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they sat down, and the information that was passed on to me in those particular rooms, in those particular groups, wasn't the information that was contained in this book, and it wasn't clear-cut instructions on how to recover from alcoholism. It wasn't a path to God or a path to a spiritual experience that could get me into a place called recovered, provided I maintain several things on a daily basis. It was a lot of information for me that I followed, that I became willing to follow, and they would say to me, you need to make lots of meetings, and I'd make lots of meetings. And I'd feel okay temporarily for a period of weeks, maybe even a couple of months. And then the spiritual malady would return, and I'd start to get a little uncomfortable. And I'd start to get a little unhappy. And everybody else in these particular rooms, and I know it's not like this everywhere, but I'm aware it's like this in a lot of places. In these particular rooms, everybody seemed to be very happy doing what they were doing. And they spoke to me about higher power, and they said, you know, Simon, you know, if you want to get sober, you need to find a higher power. I said, fine, how do I do that? And they said, well, it's got to be bigger than you. I said, well, you know, I come from no religious training or no spiritual background. What should I do? And they said, well, why don't you make it the group? And I said, okay, I'll make it the group. And they said to me, okay, so now you've made it the group, please do everything we tell you to do. I said, fine, they're a power greater than myself. I'll do what they tell me to do. But the information that was passed from a group of humans to me was the information contrary to recovering from alcoholism. It was a lot of, the book talks about a middle-of-the-road solution. And it was a lot of information that kept me very, very busy, very, very separated, and very, very shielded from bars, alcohol, and I just became living in meetings. And, you know, we've all heard it, about the information that goes on there. And I wasn't able to get sober in that environment. And what happened to me is five times in 5 years, I drank. And I went back for a one-year chip, and it was pretty much every year. I went back for a one-year chip in 5 years. And I thought it was great. You know, it's just like, oh, Simon's sober again, or Simon's relapsed again. You know, okay. And I'd go back into the meeting the next day, and I'd start, because the way the spiritual malady was at work, it hadn't been treated, I'd start talking about my problems in relationships, my problems with depression, my problems with this feeling of uselessness, my inability to make a living, and they loved it. And that is like the crazier I was, the harder they laughed. And it was like it was obviously entertaining for several people in that group. And it was like, oh, he's really sick tonight, you know. And I'd sit there. Yeah, but the thing is that I'd turn back from those meetings and I'd go home and I wouldn't want to go back and I wouldn't want to drink, but I knew I was going to have to drink because the way I was feeling and the way I was thinking was becoming unbearable. And, you know, I'd go back and they'd say to me, okay, you know, there's three sides of the triangle, you need to get involved in the three sides of the triangle. You know, why don't you get involved in service? And it was fine, I'll get involved in service. And the fellowship is the meeting, so you need to do that. You know, and what the information I was given was that I needed the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to recover. You know, I was unable to be effective in the fellowship and in service until I'd worked the 12 steps. You know, but what happened was somehow it all kind of got, it was just the wrong way round, and I was trying to be, you know, effective in service, suffering from a spiritual malady, not having any experience of working the steps, any experience of the solution, but I was trying to be busy in service, and it didn't work. I'd do the same inside the fellowship, and ask me to make lots of meetings, and I made lots of meetings. I was making a minimum of 4, a maximum of 12 meetings a week for a period of time. And it didn't treat the disease. All it did was it separated and shielded me. June 20th, 2003, after another relapse, I was contemplating suicide again. And I went to a meeting, I was taken to a meeting after a relapse, and I found it very difficult to stay in the meeting. I was sitting on my hands, and my sponsor calls it today, he said, "You were very, very disturbing." And I was contemplating either something's got to happen to me in these rooms, or I'm just going to go and I'm just going to try and do what I did in 1998, and that's to commit suicide. Because everyone wanted to talk about drinking, and people were telling me lots of ways of how to do this, but I had no introduction to the 12 steps. And I met this man, and some of you know Peter, who's my current sponsor, and he had a copy of the big book outside of the meeting, and I left the meeting and I was due to go home, and the woman had taken me to the meeting, and he said to me, "Have you had enough yet?" He said, "Have you really had enough?" And he said, "Because I've watched you for a couple of years." And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm fine, I'll just get back into it and, you know, carry the message." He said, "You've got no message to carry." He said, "Why don't you shut up for the first time in your life and just listen?" And he had this book outside, and he said, "Do you have one of these books?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Buy yourself a book." He said, "Ask me 2 questions that night." He said, "If when you want to, you can quit, are you able to do it?" And I said, "For periods of time, yeah." And he said, "Can you control the amount you take, the amount you drink once you start to drink?" And I said, "Pretty much never." And he said, "You are probably an alcoholic. And if that's the case, you may be only suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer." From that day on, I've worked with this man, and I've been shown how to work these steps. I've been introduced to the 12-step program. I worked the first 3 steps with him very quickly. He handed me a pen and a paper and he said, "Right, now you need to go and do a 4th step." And he showed me how to do it. Previously to that, a man who had sponsored me gave me very different information to that. But he showed me how to do a 4th step, as exactly how it talks about on page 64 of the book. And he said it's a 4-column inventory. List all the people, institutions and principles with whom you're angry, why you're angry with them, what it affects and what your mistake is. And he showed me, you know, on page 67, the book gives me the 4 areas of my mistakes, which is selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking and fighting. He said, "We're only looking for your grosser handicaps here. We're just looking for these 4. He said, "You know, I don't want you to write any type of life story." He said, "I just want you to look at the stuff that's currently, when you think about your re-feeling and the stuff that's currently burning you up." And we did a 4th step. It took me a few weeks, or maybe a month, I don't know. And I met with him to do a 5th step. And he said, "You're suffering from a disease that only a spiritual experience will conquer. And the promise on into action when it talks about the fifth step, is that we begin to have a spiritual experience after step five. And there are a number of promises there that he read to me, and he said to me, you know, you're going to be delighted, you're going to look the world in the eye, which was good news because I wasn't able to do it. He said, you're going to be alone at perfect peace and ease. And that was for me, it's like I was used to pacing up and down my apartment like a caged tiger, you know, most nights, running up and down with my head going, and all of this stuff. And he spoke to me about that, and he said that your fears are going to fall from you. And the work I did in the fourth step is that I saw that I was driven by fear my whole life, and it was an evil and corrosive thread the fabric of my existence was shot through me there, and I was terrified of pretty much everybody and everything. And he said that these fears are going to fall from you, and that you will start to feel the nearness of a power greater than yourself. He said, it doesn't matter what that is, as long as you know you're open and you're willing, that's all you need. And you said you're frantically on your way. So I did step five, and several days after step five, I got back to my apartment. A couple of days afterwards, I woke up, and for the first time in my life, there were no voices in my head, ever. And there was a profound silence, like, it's here, in my head. And it was quiet for the first time in my life. And then I knew that there was a change going on in me that I wasn't able to produce myself. And I started to feel power. And I no longer started to feel useless. And I no longer started to feel afraid. And I no longer started to feel out of place in this world. And my mind had calmed down. I had a mind that would always tell me that no matter how bad the consequences were on the last drink, that next time it was going to be different, and that there was always a lurking notion in my mind that, you know, I would drink. That had disappeared from me. I wasn't thinking about alcohol. I wasn't thinking of the next one. It was just quiet in my mind for the first time in my life. And when I was 6 and 7, I looked at the areas of my life that were basically an effort to run my life based on self-will, and how it was no longer everybody else's fault that I was drinking, or because of this or because of that. I started to look and take responsibility for my actions, and I saw, he said in the book, you know, that the alcohol, you know, is just a symbol. We had to get down to causes and conditions, and I saw that my whole life I'd been making decisions based on self that always put me in a position to be hurt. I saw that I was selfish, self-centered and afraid, and it was all about me, and everything I'd ever done in my life was about me, and that's it. And I said, what about the drinking? It's not about the drinking. So leaving the drink question aside, you know, we can look at how unsatisfactory living has been. And my whole life I've been making decisions based on self that put me in a position to be hurt. I did 6 and 7, and I started to write a step 8 list out. And I believe that, you know, the fourth step, it was kind of like we'd hear in AA meetings that you're working a fourth step, and my God, you know, how painful it's going to be. And it was very freeing to see this stuff for me. There was no pain attached to a fourth step. You know, the book talks about it's a house cleaning exercise. That any business that usually goes broke, that doesn't do inventory, usually goes broke. And in that, it was a fact-finding, a fact-facing process, you know, and it wasn't about, you know, all this stuff that happened. It was just about, you know, the selfishness and self-seeking behaviour and the dishonesty and the fear and common fall that we're interested in, not really in 1 and 2. And I started to write a step 8 list out, and for the first time on that step 8 list, I saw or came face-to-face with the illness. For the first time, I came face to face, and I looked at the destruction that had been caused in my life as a result of this selfishness and self-seeking behaviour, as a result of this mental obsession, and the phenomenon of craving that would take place in my body when I put it in there. And we also looked, and he showed me this thing about the spiritual malady, and we looked at page 52, and I saw that, you know, the bedevilments on page 52 was what I was going into Alcoholics Anonymous and talking about for a number of years because I was experiencing them, but how that they would disappear when I started to go out and clean up my past. And the book talks about with amends that we had to take the bit in our teeth. simple sorry won't fit the bill, and that how much we must be willing, no matter what the personal consequences were. And as a result of this selfishness and self-centeredness, there were a lot of consequences, and a lot of people I needed to go out and make direct amends to, and some of those I bought. And it was shown to me in the book here where what the promises would be if I was to do this. And I had to go, that if I didn't go out and clean these amends, that nothing worthwhile in life would be accomplished until I do so. And I started to go out and I started to look down the list and approach these people with regards to amends. And I didn't really have a great deal of power to do that, but he said, as you do this, more and more power will come into your life, and you'll be given power to go and do this. And I've had experience after experience after experience with Night Step Amends. There was an employer that I used to steal from, who I stole his time. He employed me and I was never really there. I had abused him, his employees. I'd taken from him, and he'd kept my job open for months on end whilst I was in institutions. I went back and I made amends to that man, and that man employs me today. I went back to make amends to my mum and my sister, who were still very, very ill as a result of this. And I sat down with them and frankly analysed the past. And what happened with me is I started to get more and more power in my life. I was no longer, you know, powerless. I started to have an experience with power. And I started to feel the presence of a higher power in my life. And I started to see the presence of this power working in my life. I sat down with my mum and my sister. And there was a lot of money that I should have pay back. My sister was a younger girl. She wanted an older brother and she idolised me. She wanted her older brother back. One thing that I realised making the amends with my family is that I underestimated the human capacity to forgive. And these two women forgive me as I started to pay the money back and as I started to ask to do to them what they wanted. And it wasn't just a question of me going back and saying sorry. You know, I approached the amends through prayer that I adopted. And I went back to my mum and to my sister. And I asked them what I needed to do to repair the damage done. And I was told to shut up. And I was told to listen to what they wanted me to do very carefully. And my sponsor said at the time, he said, what they ask you to do, you need to do, that's your amend, and you need to follow through with it. I was unable to make amends to my father directly. He'd passed away some years before that. Again, I sought counsel with a sponsor and I was told that graveside amends may be worth doing with your father. And I went back to my father's grave and I sat down with him and I went into prayer and I asked my father what I needed to do to repair the damage done to him whilst he was alive and what he wanted me to do with the family. And the guidance I got while sitting down with my dad is that to look after his wife and to his daughter, which is my mum and sister. That's what I do to make amends to my dad today, is that I look after my mum and I look after my sister. I show up in their lives today. I take an interest in their lives. I show up at family functions and I show up with the newfound power and freedom that I've been given in this programme. 4 through 9 cleared the past for me. It cleared away a lot of the wreckage of the past and it gave me an understanding to what my grosser handicaps were. And it cleared the path for me and I started to access real power as a result of 4 through 9. I started to feel the presence of power and I started to become very, very powerful with that power. With that power, I know that it doesn't come from me. I'm aware of where that power comes from today. That power comes from what I believe is a loving God that I've accessed here, that I've been shown how to access. And 10, 11 and 12, I maintain and I grow the relationship with that power. There are other amends that I've had to do that have been ongoing. Some I've had to go clear up immediately, some I haven't, where people have, if I would have made amends, then people would have been hurt, so I haven't done it. But I've done over, I think, you know, a good number of amends over about a year period. And I don't owe any money today. There is nobody on that list who I'm not willing. There are three people left on that list who I am completely willing to make a direct amends to them whenever they show up in my life. I've tried to contact them. People that I haven't found in amends, you know, I've gone onto internet websites to people tracing service to go find those people, and I've had to clear away a lot of that stuff. And as a result of that, you know, a lot of the promises have come true in my life. And we get to step 10, and we vigorously commence this way of living. You know, as we cleaned up the past, you know, that means I start working 10 the moment I start going out and going making amends, because I need to watch out for the daily stuff, because it was explained to me that these defects of character are not going to go away. In the book it says we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment and fear. It says when these crop up. It doesn't say if these crop up, it says when, which means they're going to crop up. And I had to watch, asked to watch for this stuff as it comes up, and as and when it does come up, I'm given some very simple instructions on page 84 on how to do that. Page 84 says, when this comes up, I need to ask God immediately to remove it, discuss it immediately with somebody, and it also says in the book, discuss it, not dump it. You know, and I often hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, oh, you know, let's just go and dump this, I just need to dump this, I just need to dump that. And I've learned the hard way with my sponsor that this is about discussion, and he's not interested in dumping or me dumping on this. It's about a discussion. I'm asked to go make amends where I've done harm immediately, and resolutely turn my thoughts towards somebody else I could help. And every time that I get caught in this, because my experience is that it does come back, no matter what I'm doing, it does come back. I need to practice that. I've not thought about alcohol, obsessed about alcohol in 3.5 years today. You know, I'm active in sponsorship and working with the disciplines in steps 10 and 11. It allows me to stay clear, and it allows me to stay free during my day so that I can be more effective. You know, the couple of the step 10 promises there, it says, you know, the problem has been removed, and it says, also says that the problem does not exist for us. You know, and that's why I introduced myself as a recovered alcoholic. You know, for me, that's the biggest promise in the book. I don't think you can get any more recovered than the problem not existing. You know, today I'm aware what I'm given on a daily basis is a daily reprieve, and that I remain with the problem not existing contingent on the maintenance and growth of my spiritual condition in 10 and 11. The subject of prayer, the meditation arose, and it was suggested that I do that straight away. And today I pray and meditate every day. I meditate with meditations in the book here, but also the book talks about there are lots of other useful books that we can make use of. And at the moment I'm working with a book where I'm working with two practices. Number one is where I'm trying to do my best in everything I do, and number two, I'm trying to be impeccable with my word. Because prior to that, you know, I would tell you I'd do things for you and not do them. I would tell you that I'd do something and not carry it out. And I try and work on being impeccable with my word today. And that's taking me into a new way of living, where if I promise you I'm going to do something, I do it. If you want me somewhere at a certain time, I'll be there. If my mum wants me home for Christmas, I go back to my home to be there for Christmas. If I promise things to people, if I'm working with a prospect and I'm promising this, you know, I do it and I show up at a certain time. And I'm working with these disciplines alongside, you know, prayer and meditation. The suggestions are in here, but I've found that there's been many helpful books that I've been taught to do along with Alcoholics Anonymous, not instead of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was taught that I should do this along with, and I need to maintain and grow that the relationship with that power. I do a morning prayer, and I do the first three steps every morning. I ask God to divorce my thinking from self-pity, self-seeking, dishonest motives. I consider my day, then I go into prayer. At night I do an evening review. I look for where I've been resentful, I look for where I've been selfish, I look for where I've been intolerant and impatient, and I look to grow in these areas. And a lot of the time I fall short in those questions, and a lot of the time the answer, you know, reveals itself out of the information there. And I do that nightly review so that in the morning, the following morning, I'm able to sit in meditation and I can get a lot quieter. And I don't have the voices in my head from the day, from yesterday, about what you didn't do or how you should have done that. Or, you know, I'm able to get quiet. And for me, that's amazing. I'm able to just sit in quietness in the morning and I get guidance. You know, for me, God, I've accessed God as a result of working these 12 steps. And what I do is I continue to work and I continue to rework these steps because I need to stay current in this. And I had a spiritual experience 3.5 years ago, but that spiritual experience 3.5 years ago, that isn't as powerful to keep me sober today. And I need to maintain and I need to grow this. The spiritual experience that I experienced was that essential psychic change for the obsession to be removed. And an entire emotional rearrangement. And the third step prayer says that we were reborn. And I am a new man today. I'm not the man I was 3.5 years ago. But through working with steps 10 and 11, through staying current, through practicing prayer, through sitting through very uncomfortable mornings in meditation sometimes, getting used to practicing meditation, I get new awakenings and I get new experiences on a daily basis. I'm able to take that and I'm able to go into the 12th step with that by working with others. And then the book again is pretty clear with me that I can't rely on that spiritual experience I had 3 years ago. I need to continue to maintain and grow through self-sacrifice and work with others. And I've been blessed and I've been given prospects to work with on a daily basis. And I'm able to take this power there. To those prospects and back into this fellowship. And my sponsor said to me at the time, you know, he said, well, there's a condition to this. You didn't get sober just to sit on a beach and get well and get a suntan. You didn't get sober just to be good in your job or just to earn money. You've been getting sober for a reason, and that reason is to go help other people and to go carry this message to other people. And I take that as a very, very big commitment and a very, very big responsibility today. That's where I grow in understanding and effectiveness when I'm working with others. You know, I get given this power for myself. I got given this power to go help other people. And from what I see, especially where I'm from, there's a lot of work to be done in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? A lot of the work that I have to do, or we have to do, where I live in France is... I'm blessed to be able to do it. I'm given a great responsibility. This world where we live is pretty middle of the road. I'm given truth and I'm given power to go back and to help others. I think I'll leave it there. Thanks.